I'd like to call to order this regular meeting of the Boulder Valley School District Board of Education for Tuesday, April 21st, 2026. Board members may attend and participate in meetings remotely in accordance with Board Policy BMEA and state law. Laura, can you please call the roll?
Booker.
Here.
Chavez. Medler. Quinlan Weda.
Here.
Rajpal.
Here.
Temu Adeng.
Here.
Adeng. Or, sorry, Unger.
Here.
Thank you.
I'd like to encourage folks to turn their attention to the screen for the land acknowledgement this morning.
The Boulder Valley School District resides and operates on land that is the ancestral homeland and unjustly and illegally taken territory of the Ute, Puebloan, Arapaho, Cheyenne, Apache, Navajo, and 48 other tribal nations historically tied to this land, who have called this land home since time immemorial. We acknowledge the atrocities committed here, including the painful history of genocide, forced assimilation, and efforts to alienate the indigenous inhabitants from their homeland, supported by the policies of the United States government. BVSD is aware of the many indigenous peoples, past and present, and their dignified nations and cultures, who care for this land with strength and resilience. BVSD recognizes the histories of the land in Colorado and the survival of many nations that carried their oral traditions into the present. It is BVSD's responsibility to educate ourselves, our community, and our students so that we can embrace the wisdom and knowledge of Indigenous peoples and actively stand together to address injustices. In offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm and honor the history, wisdom, oral traditions, and resilience of Indigenous people, and recognize the responsibility to care for and appreciate this land together.
I'd like to make a note for the board secretary that board member Chavez is now present. And after that, I'd like to, the mission of the Boulder Valley School District is to create challenging, meaningful, and engaging learning opportunities so that all children thrive and are prepared for successful, civically engaged lives. Good morning, everyone. We're happy to have you here participating in our meeting this morning. At this time, is there a motion to approve today's agenda? Moved by Lelania, seconded by Anna. Laura, can you please call the motion?
Kerr?
Yes.
Chavez?
Yes.
Medler. Quinlan Weda.
Yes.
Rajpal.
Yes.
Temu Adeng.
Yes.
Unger.
Yes.
Motion passes.
Today we have one item on our agenda for under work session study. We're going to take a deep look at BVSD's strategic plan and UIP. I'll turn it over to Dr. Anderson for introductions.
Thank you, Board President Rajpal, board members. Good to see you all this morning. Excited to give the board another update on our strategic plan and begin to talk about the development of our next UIP here in April. We've got lots of folks on our team here. They're going to be talking about different aspects of the strategic plan. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. De La Cruz, who will do introductions of the team and get us started.
Good morning, President Rajpal, members of the board. So good to be here again to provide an update on our strategic plan altogether for all students and also information about the UIP development for the next 2-year cycle of the UIP. And with me today are members of our team who will be sharing from their expertise. I have Chris Brock, Director of Strategic Initiatives, Dr. Jessica Alzine, Executive Director of Accountability and Evaluation. Across from me, Dr. Nativity Miller, Chief Academic Officer, Dr. Emma Herzog, Executive Director of Academics, and Dr. Bianca Gallegos, Executive Director of Strategic Partnerships. Today, we're going to be touching on our current work within the four strategic priorities of Altogether for All Students. Of course, No Limits, Next Best Step, Valued and Included, and Define the Destination. You'll also hear information about the UIP development process threaded throughout various parts of today's conversation, with UIP connections discussed in a few different places this morning. And as part of Define the Destination and the CTE update discussion, we have a treat. We're going to be taking a walking work session to tour our CTE center at APEX to see the CTE Pathways expansion with student ambassadors. And we'll have lunch at the Culinary Center, where the students will be preparing and serving lunch. And this is actually perfect because right now they're studying back of the house hospitality and culinary experiences. And as the board knows, we have a cycle of reporting to you all every year. And of course, here we are in April with an update on strategic priorities and also the UIP development, since we're entering a new two-year UIP cycle next year. And up next, Chris is going to draw some initial connections to our Altogether for All Students strategic plan and updates about the third cohort of the strategic plan support team.
Good morning, Board President Rajpal, members of the board. Thank you for having us. You all have seen this slide before, just to kind of anchor us into a structure for today. Similar to previous work sessions, we'll walk through some updates for each of these objectives. They will be slightly out of order because we're going to end on Define the Destination as we walk into APEX and do some CTE exploration there. But just wanted to give you some sense of structure for the rest of the day. But first, I want to talk about how we are expanding our strategic plan support teams into cohort three. That will result in 30 schools in 3 years receiving this targeted support. Also incredibly excited about the fact that with our focus around the implementation of data-driven instruction and leadership support from that team, we do feel like that we are at a critical mass of the data-driven instructional practices across the system, a great foundation for us to continue to build on within our strategic plan. As a reminder, we have defined success within our strategic plan around increased achievement growth for all and historically marginalized students, appropriate growth for students receiving academic interventions, proportional rate of students identified for special education and gifted and talented, increased percentage of students who graduate and obtain at least one Grad Plus recognition, increased fidelity to the BBSD discipline framework, and to decrease out-of-school suspensions while reducing disproportionality. So as many of you know, we have so many celebrations already within our long-term objectives within the strategic plan, and we're going to continue to build on that in the next iteration of the UIP. This is also a reminder for you all. We talked about this sort of previous work session on how our work around the development of the district UIP trickles down into the specific short cycle improvement that you're going to see in schools. So I want to make sure we highlight that. So the district UIP centers around the identification of student performance priorities and major improvement strategies that the district will take. We align those within each of the four strategic objectives. And then action plans are created using a two-year improvement cycle through the district UIP. So right now we are concluding the first iteration of that, which was fall 2024 to spring of 2026. And we are moving into the development of the UIP for fall 2026 through spring of 2028. Then as schools develop their 90-day plans, their short cycle improvement strategies, we ask that they align those specific performance priorities to the district UIP. That way we ensure alignment all the way up to the things that we know we want to prioritize and hold dear as we try to achieve the different metrics within the strat plan. So to start off, we're going to talk around No Limits, and I'm going to hand it off to Dr. Miller.
Good morning. Dr. Herzog and I will be sharing an update on No Limits, specifically around the professional learning that we have continued to do with our leaders for grade level standards and how we've connected that to the curricular resources that we've adopted. And then a brief update on how we're utilizing our district coaches that Chris talked about for DDI implementation. So first, we want to share the work that we have continued to do with professional learning at grade level standards. We've been grounded in this quote, what does mastery of each standard look like? And what do students need to know and be able to do? And what is the rigor required? So the work that we have done from the academics department has been through the lens of continued professional learning on cognitive lift and Webb's depth of knowledge, which is what we talked to you about in the fall. So just as a reminder, we shared that what that means is how do we address instruction for the and increase students' level of thinking on various levels throughout their day. We have worked to provide learning to leaders so they can lead teachers by identifying what mastery looks like for each standard and our teachers' ability to understand what students need to know and be able to do for all the standards in which they teach. Over the course of the year, we have provided our leaders with professional learning, and we have directly tied that to the curricular resources that we've adopted because we know that those curricular resources are aligned to grade level standards. And we've worked to create a system so that we are raising the level of cognitive lift through the depth of knowledge in their daily instruction. So through their professional development, we've been teaching them so that they can teach their teachers, and we've been connecting that with their curricular resources so they can identify where to do that in the tools that they have. We've also had the opportunity to highlight several of our leaders who've begun this work in a variety of starting points. We've really tried to emphasize as an exec team that the starting point for every leader is different based on the work that's in their 90-day plan, the climate and culture of their building, all those things. But we've just asked them to start. And so what we've done is we've highlighted, I think the first session we highlighted four different leaders that highlighted various different starting points to do this work with their staff. And actually this afternoon, we're going to be highlighting two more leaders who've just chosen different paths. But our point is that you can start wherever that needs to be. We just would like you to start.
Nativity, I have a quick question. And so for those, for the professional learning around this and the leaders that are finding where to start, is that within those cohorts that are already predetermined, or is it in all schools across the district?
So
all grade levels?
This is not specifically to the SPST schools. This is the professional learning that we're providing at PK-12 with all leaders.
All right. Building on that and in connection with our professional learning, I feel like this mic is on the wrong side, so I'll flip it for next time. As you know, we're continuing to adopt high quality instructional materials that support our strategic plan initiative of students experiencing grade level standards-based instruction. Across the content areas listed on the slide, we've adopted high quality core instructional materials within the last 4 years. For example, in math across K-12, we have a new core curricular resource over the last 3 years. In ELA across K-8, we have a new curricular resource over the last 3 years. In science, we have STEM scopes for kindergarten and FOSS kits for grades 1 through 5. And in social studies, we're currently in an adoption for middle school. We're also editing our existing K-5 social studies units to ensure they're aligned with updated CDE standards and updating links that no longer work, making sure that we're using high quality nationally known resources. Every time we begin with a new curricular resource, our content teams design implementation plans to support that resource. Implementation plans include principal and teacher-facing professional learning, school-based learning walks, and other forms of individual school-based support, like sitting with a team to plan or co-teaching with a teacher to help them understand how to use the resources in alignment with grade level standards. Our work as an academics team is to support implementation, but before an adoption even starts, it's also become our role to partner with educators to help create the conditions of readiness for new materials, particularly at the secondary level. To do this, our teams have engaged in listening tours at every building with those department teams, and then have created working groups that both address some of the key takeaways from those listening tours and plan for how to continue to improve and refine our standards-aligned course offerings going forward across buildings. In social studies, for example, that doing that work was critical to help us ensure readiness at the middle level for middle school adoption, because once we got there, teachers were clear on what standards needed to look like and sound like, and our shared beliefs as a district for what social studies instruction should look like in middle school. While we're proud of all the work that has been done over the past several years in partnership with educators, and proud of how we're leveraging high quality core curricular resources as helpful tools to get to the depth required of each standard, we also know we have more work to do as we continue to improve and refine our instructional resources and teaching practices.
All right. In the last section, before we share a little bit of data, is our continued work to, again, grade level standards through the utilization of data-driven instruction and the use of assessment. For data-driven instruction, as many of you already know, we have district DDI coaches that are embedded in our schools, and they cover about 25 schools currently, and that's between the academics team and the SPST teams. Their role is to support schools and guide them through implementation. As coaches and facilitators, they work on building understanding of standards mastery, as well as guiding the teachers and leaders through the long-term implementation of DDI. So the academics team district coaches we're in our fourth year, and we're cycling through. Many of them have moved to, our goal always is to build the capacity in the school. So many of them have moved to coaching the coaches and coaching the leaders. And so they're no longer facilitating the meetings, but they're observing and providing feedback on a consistent basis. An essential part of the DDI process is to unpack a standard, as we've mentioned, and identifying what students need to know and be able to do, which is the foundational work to ensuring our students have access to grade level standards. Additionally, we've been working on refining our assessment calendar for greater standards alignment. Over the course of the last few years, we have had vendor assessments and platforms as part of our calendar, but now we are working to also view and pull data on the embedded units that we're using within our curriculum. For example, we now have K-5 into reading and 6-8 into math, because ultimately we want them to do is instruct, assess, and that's part of their DDI cycle. We continue to increase clarity and understanding system-wide. For example, we've recently engaged our middle school math task force to generate 2 common assessments aligned with the major work of their grade. We are working to improve and refine our common assessment structures, and it is the first time we have had standards data in connection to core resources in various content areas, which again allows for educators to leverage the data-driven instruction cycle at a high level because they have the assessments that are aligned to the standards that they are teaching. Now that we've heard a little bit of our status implementation for professional learning, curricular resources, as well as data-driven instruction, Dr. Herzog will provide a quick update on some data that we have right now for April.
So given all of that information, a question that we were asking ourselves is, what have we seen from beginning of year to middle of year? And as a result, what might we expect as a result for end of year? So to support school leaders with their middle of year data, Dr. Alzin and her team reviewed common assessment data from beginning of year to middle of year. For math, the team used IXL K-5 and NWA MAP 6-8, and for literacy, ELA M-Class for K-5 and Common Lit for 6-12. They found through that the percentage of students scoring at or above benchmark increased by 3-6% across literacy assessments and increased by 2-5% on math assessments. We know that our leading indicators show we're continuing to make progress. What we don't know yet is how that progress will correlate with CMAS scores. Once our CMAS scores come out next fall, Dr. Alzin and her team are planning to analyze those scores in connection with our common assessments so that we have local data to inform how our common interim assessments are correlating with our CMAS results. On our academics end, when middle of year data comes in, our academics content teams review the data and they use it to adjust where they're offering additional targeted supports to schools throughout the year. For example, our math team has a menu of options for coaching that they offer elementary schools in phase 1 as part of illustrative math implementation. However, after middle of year IXL data comes in, they have additional follow-ups with school leaders who may have had lower student data to partner in figuring out what sorts of support are best needed for that school from the math team to improve results going forward. I'll now pass it over to Chris, who will talk about our UIP process and future considerations.
Thank you. So, as Dr. Herzog mentioned, we obviously aren't going to have the lagging indicator data until we get the CMAS results in the fall to be really specific on what those UIP targets might be. However, we do want to be able to identify some opportunities and considerations within each of the 4 objectives so that we can begin the planning process now. And then as we get that data in the fall, we'll be able to identify more specific targets. So building off of the data that Dr. Herzog just mentioned, as well as the data that we are aware of from last year's CMAS data, we have an opportunity to address inconsistent growth in math. And a few of the considerations as we develop this UIP are around the current district-wide implementation of math at all levels. So we are in some phase of implementation of new math materials across the entire district. We anticipate that that will continue to support the math growth. We also know that the development of DDI, as I mentioned before, we feel like we're at a critical mass of DDI best practices across the system. However, we may have schools that are very focused in on literacy within DDI. We can encourage them to expand that focus into math focus with DDI. We can obviously continue to support secondary schools with math teams as they implement their data-driven instructional practices as well. And then what you're going to see at every one of for each of these objectives is our ongoing support of schools in their 90-day plans. So as they identify specific targets and leading indicators to support their math growth and achievement within their buildings, we'll be able to walk alongside them and provide the necessary support that they can reach their individual student goals. So some potential UIP indicators to think about could be administrator learning walks, observation of math reteaches. So that's one of the things that we would all want to be able to see in schools as a part of our DDI practices. Continued PD on depth of knowledge. As Dr. Miller mentioned, this is something that we're going to continue to support schools in the understanding of so that we can identify the best instructional practices to observe across the system. There we go. Pause for questions.
Thank you for that overview on the first no limits portion of the strategic plan. Board members, who would like to begin with questions or comments? Dr. Anderson.
I just want to start by saying how proud I am of the work that our district has done to have a strategic planning process driving outcomes in classrooms, driving professional development, to have revamped our curriculum, to have high quality instructional materials across the board, to have a balanced assessment system, to have measures of progress that are meaningful. I reflect on when we started in 2019 developing this strategic plan and some of the aspirations that we may have had 7 years ago, watching them be ingrained in the culture of our school district is incredibly powerful. And I just want to thank this team for all the work that you've done. And I'm just really, really proud of where we are. And we have set a set of district conditions that's allowing educators and schools to thrive. And I'm just really appreciative.
I have a couple questions. I was wondering, the comment was made about continue to improve instructional resources, teaching practices, and DDI. Can you speak to, so then we kind of had that UIP flash of maybe some math-focused stuff, but I was just wondering if you could expand on where do you feel like the next place we need to focus, particularly on instructional resources, that our investment in those, the curriculum materials has been significant, all the alignment work, the professional learning, but where do you feel is the next place that you, or next two places where you feel like that improvement, it needs to be most targeted?
Thank you for the question. We've started, but where we really see some continued need is high school social studies, secondary science, and high school ELA. And I think, you know, I initially actually had that in my narrative and then I took it out because I think what's so important about that is it needs to be in partnership and co-constructed with teachers through that process that I described, right? We have teachers at all of those grade levels doing amazing things. And so the power of these task forces has really been to bring that together, deepen shared understanding of what's required by the standard for excellence, and then say like, okay, what are the key experiences in each of these courses that we value as a district and how do we put that together? One example is we don't have a core resource in 6-8 science, but we've started the task force work on that. We already had our first day. We have our next day coming up next week. And our STEAM director and science coordinator have done an incredible job. And that's the, like, I believe one of the the first time where educators have been in a room to try to norm across the district, what does this science course look like and sound like? And what it will allow us to do from there is right now we have a repertoire of supplemental resources that are used in different ways in different buildings to different degrees. But once we can agree on what are the key standards, what are the scope by semester, and what are the key learning experiences, then we'll be able to do an analysis of the supplemental resources we have, decide what is a fit to support that work, what might we discontinue, and what does that mean going forward for any sort of core high quality adoption. We've been doing a little bit of that work behind the scenes in literacy. Our new literacy director, who's phenomenal, Stephanie Anderson, has been inventorying all of our supplemental platforms, and we had one supplemental platform that was repetitive with the purpose of some others, didn't have high use, and was a significant cost. So over time, as we look to phase things out to free up some dollars, we can then work with teachers to be strategic about how do we want to repurpose those dollars for our shared vision of what each of these courses should be like at secondary.
And I think just to add a little bit, I think one of the things that we felt grateful for and what Dr. Anderson support is we are taking the time to, what I always say, do the back of the house work, which sometimes doesn't speed up the process. But I think what we've learned is if we implement something without having done that, we're going to be fighting the battle on the other side. And so we've really taken time to unpack what is actually the problem. And then, as Emma said, we've built a structure where engaging teachers for a year or half of a year to calibrate that and then adopting a resource has really actually increased our momentum when we go to implement. But it does take a little longer on the back end.
I totally agree. And I appreciate that. Anecdotally, those would have been the three areas that I would have, based on feedback that I hear, would have thought that that's where next steps would be. So I'm really excited to see where that kind of takes shape and how that unfolds. My other question was on slide 12, where you showed K-12 literacy increasing by 3 to 6%, K-8 math by 2 to 5%. Those are big, that's a lot of students in there. And there's probably, I'm wondering, are there areas where you're not seeing increases in those ranges? Are there areas of concerns or hotspots in there? I just don't want to make sure we're not blanketing over some areas of that might not look like that.
I don't have that at my fingertips at this moment, but we do have some slides that I can pull from and see and get you an answer to that.
Thanks. And then my last question was really around slide 13 and some of, like, as we're thinking ahead to the new UIP. I mean, UIPs, as you said at the outset, are really structured around a priority performance area. We have implementation benchmarks, we have action steps. Are you thinking that, like, I'm trying to put this slide into the construct of a traditional UIP, and I'm wondering what the priority performance area would be. Is it just inconsistent growth of math, and that's going to be the one we're going to focus on, or how are you seeing this? And I know we have some UIP slides at the very end as well, so if you don't want to wait for that, but just know, like, when I look at all of these summary slides on UIP considerations, that's what I'm having spent a decade looking at UIPs. That's where my mind goes, and I'm excited to just get a little bit more shape in what we're thinking about, because October will be upon us pretty quickly, and we're not going to have a lot of time to see that UIP before it really has its shape.
Yeah, it's a great question. So these slides are very intentionally drafted in terms of considerations. The student performance priorities, obviously, we want to be able to have a hard data point to identify what the appropriate SMART goals is that we can set around each of those things. So the opportunity that we've outlined is really us looking at previous historical data, what we've had last year at the end of when we were able to look at CMAS data in the fall. This was one of the opportunities that we identified. That doesn't mean that we won't see significant increases in the fall, and we may have to right size that. So this is very much just an opportunity that we are considering right now, and we want to be really prepared once we do have that data and identify the right targets for it. It doesn't mean that we're closed off to other opportunities within no limits to identify the right UIP target based on what that data shows us in the fall.
And it might also be because we are so tightly aligned to the strategic plan, we can wait until we get some of that postmortem CMAS data to really refine. We're in years past because the UIP has been a standalone document that's not tightly aligned to the strategic plan. the process has been a little bit different. And so I hear that. And I think that CMAS data is going to be really important for, to inform. I'm just, you know, and so that's just trying to get from one process to the new process and just thinking that through. So I appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes. And Jessica will foreshadow some of that today in some initial thinking around draft growth and achievement goals for UIP for your feedback. And we'll undoubtedly be looking at student groups as we develop the UIP as well as English language arts.
Alex.
Yeah, first, I apologize for my tardiness. Some stuff out of my control. And also, huge kudos to the entire team for what I think is amazing stuff from before I came to the board of starting to see the benefits of like many years of really hard and intentional work. So I really do think celebration is in order. I have a couple of questions. I am interested in more data than those that are getting over the standard benchmark. I'm really interested in knowing, you know, like what the standard deviation is between schools and, you know, to what Nicole was talking to of understanding, you know, where it's strong and where it's harder. I'm also interested in knowing about the growth by students at different levels in our achievement spectrum, because we really do want to make sure we are still accelerating and differentiating and finding every student where they are with this new curriculum, not having any sort of bubble kid, you know, dynamic going on. And so as we get deeper in the implementation of all these materials, I really am interested in the full spectrum of our kids and their needs and the subpopulations and the school by school variation and implementation. And I realize that's a lot, so I'm not saying do more, but that's the kind of stuff I'm sure your DDI teams are working on. So if there's something that we can roll up from that that's appropriate for a governing board to look at, I'd love to see it at some level. And I have a question. I have a comment. I am curious, of all the people working on this that are in schools every day working on DDI, how many might be coded as being central administrative staff that a reporter would get wrong? And how many are working every day in our schools that aren't school-based employees in our accounting? That's one sort of pet peeve. But the other one is really to get at, like, I see this as a total culture shift for this district to have centralized curriculum and an instructional support system. Right. So I am curious to know what are sort of the obstacles we still have in sort of a changing district culture to do this. And how is that trend? It must be working because we're getting it to happen. And that would have been pretty much impossible 15 years ago. So what are we doing to really win district culture to do this is my question.
I too would comment on your, I think what I can say for support in schools is everybody under the academics team is in schools at some point. So Emma and I have an internal deployment dashboard that I don't need to bore you with the details of. However, we know how many school support structures we have every month, every week, whether that's principal coaching, teacher coaching, professional learning in schools, our teams, like we're able to quantify that on a regular basis and know, you know, and we also look at themes. So if we're getting multiple requests for math, for example, then what I can do is go to Dr. De La Cruz and say, it looks like we need to do something at a universal level because I have 30 requests on X topic. So we've used that internally, but everybody on our team is in schools at some point during their week, whether they're doing any of those things and or providing professional learning. So that's first. And then I think, what can you say your last question again in terms of building the culture?
Yeah, I just think having a centralized instructional infrastructure is kind of new and a big change from where we were 10 years ago as a district. So I'm curious what the obstacles are and what are the assets we're able to leverage as we move towards having a strong district culture about a shared focus on outcomes and learning for everybody.
I mean, I think the one challenge that we face in academics is time, as everybody, for professional learning. So we are prioritizing everything to the strategic plan, but as you know, many things fit in the strategic plan. But we are having to be very creative on how we're getting to teachers and providing training because we don't have a very robust professional learning calendar with teachers. And so we have limited time to be able to take all the things and provide that learning with them. Because we have principals on a regular basis monthly, we can build their capacity, which we're trying to build capacity so that they can build capacity in the schools. But I would say one of our greatest obstacles, I think, is the time that we have with teachers to get deep in this work.
And if I may, I would add that an intentional step we've taken over years to build the culture across BVSD has been to really lean into leading through the tenets of implementation science and looking toward how we can close the knowing-doing gap, and also incremental improvements over time so that we get really good at foundational structures and practices, and then keep building from there. We get stronger with each new instructional practice and structure, and then we build from there. And that really has allowed us to build the climate and culture across the district where there's much more ownership and understanding about these practices.
Jorge.
Thank you for this. It's great to see the progress that's being made and like the efforts, you know, to really target the DDI and to get to a standard curriculum and make sure we're teaching those standards. I'm curious, as a part of this, where does differentiation fit in? What kind of support is available in PD to address this as we move towards that standardization to make sure that we're supporting those students that needed additional help? And how does that kind of fit into this part of that as part of the DDI coaching and as part of the PD that's in here in the mix?
I would say that it fits in all of it, right? So what we're really working towards is implementation of the MTSS framework, because those are the structures that allow us to intervene with students who need more support and or accelerating students who are. And so I think the implementation of both the MTSS framework structures as well as data-driven instruction, those consistent cycles allow teachers and leaders to identify where we're still needing, where students are needing support and where we can accelerate. And then obviously also connected is assessments, right? So having those assessments that we need to be able to identify what are the skill gaps and or where are the enrichment areas. Professional learning wise, I think where we're starting to get is how can we differentiate for schools in a way through our Leadership Academy that will be coming up in June. We're already working with the executive directors on planning that so that we can start doing a little more differentiation for support for them because of where they are. The other pieces I think that fit in the strategic plan but aren't necessarily named is we are also still providing co-teaching support for our English language development. So we have a whole sustainability plan that we're working on in schools. My whole CLDE team has been out in schools all year long, coaching at schools every 2 weeks. So they spend a week there observing, coaching, giving feedback on providing, you know, linguistic supports and teaching and co-teaching throughout this whole year. It's not named in here, but we're still doing that work, and it is aligned, in my opinion, to the work that we're still doing. So that would be like another example.
The only other thing I would add to my wonderful boss to my left is, you know, I think we've probably all been in situations where if you don't have strong core instruction with deep understanding of the standards, you get to differentiation really quickly, and all of a sudden you have 80% of your class that's in a small group for some sort of intervention, where it wasn't an intervention or a differentiation problem, it was a core tier one problem. So that's not to say we can't do any differentiating until we get core where it needs to be, but I think from across the country, we've learned that once you have a strong core aligned with standards, the differentiation becomes decreased just like we would want it to, both for acceleration, like for acceleration and intervention. And so I think the caution piece is it can be hard if teachers are diagnosing a student needs intervention before they deeply understand what mastery of that lesson or that week looks like. So it really has to happen in tandem.
And then I'll add to my amazing word here. I think the other piece in connection to what you're saying is that we're working on with teachers is understanding that differentiation and or acceleration is not a person or a place. We need to build the skills of our teachers in the classroom so that we can do it within our structures, so that we don't have to send kids somewhere or we don't need another person, but we do need to build their skills to be, it's hard. It is very hard, but that's something as we get through implementation, as Board Member Medler mentioned, teaching teachers the stuff that's in the box takes time, and it can be overwhelming because there's a lot of resources. But once we get past that, what we really are working on focusing on is the teaching and learning part, and how that they can use the curricular resources as a foundation and know we're getting to standard, but also how do I differentiate for a student in my classroom, because it might just be on that one standard. It doesn't mean forever, right? And so we have to teach them how to do that within the class. It can happen outside, but I like people to not think it's always a person or a place to go.
Thank you. I really appreciate that kind of thoughtful response. And the question I ask it because I know it's happening, and I know it's an important component of it, and that meeting to standards actually helps all of our students, mm-hmm. right? So addressing that, and given our strategic plan, highlighting that it's bringing everybody along, right? Mm-hmm. And making fun ways to kind of meet them where they're at and support them. And so in my mind, figuring out how we can kind of emphasize that and kind of bring it into the UIP to better align it and to make it more visible, because we're doing that extra work. And it's important for folks to recognize that that's actually happening in the classroom. That's where it needs to be happening. And the additional supports matter. And as we look at, you know, thinking about our schools for next year, right, that to the degree that we can kind of right size our schools, it'll be easier to do that sort of work is important to kind of emphasize. Thank you.
Dr. Anderson, then Anna, and then Deanne. I'm trying to listen for a hand up remotely, but if there's questions that come up, please let me know.
Thanks, Board President Raj Paul. I just want to lift something up that that may be going under the radar for some folks. I know for our team, this is at the core of what we do. When it comes to district improvement, school improvement, sequencing matters. And when we talk about change, we constantly talk about pace and cadence, scope and scale. And if you can try to do all the right things. This is just my perception of what it is I think that we're doing differently that's allowing us to achieve at the levels that we are. It's that we have taken what we know the research says works, right? And then we've sequenced it in the right ways. Right. And then we've rolled it out at the right pace, with the right cadence, with the right scope, with the appropriate scale. So when Laura says that we keep getting stronger and stronger and stronger, it's by design. It's not by happen chance. And if you have an autonomous school district with schools that are trying to set all those things in isolation without the support of a district, the district conditions and infrastructure, what you get is haphazard implementation. What you get is some kids, based on where they live or the school that they happen to attend, get something very different than somewhere else. So as we think about improvement plans and the alignment and all of the things we're talking about, I don't want to miss this opportunity to really lift up, not just to our community and to this board, but for others who might be watching, how are we continuing to be successful year in and year out? Sequencing. And a level of change management that has allowed us to unfreeze the things that weren't working, change the practices that we know are best, and now we're in the refreeze where we are culturally embedding how we do business across the system. And so I just kind of wanted to lift that up. I get really excited to watch, you know, but I want to make sure that we're telling that story.
First, I do want to say just how impressive it is to see the cohesion and the improvement that you all are doing for all of these core curriculums. I do want to know how you are thinking about how this is going to incorporate into Magic School.
Good question. On the roadmap that's coming. So, I mean, you know, as we mentioned with the AI update, I think we have to be honest in saying that with all these curricular resources that we've been quickly adopting, we have not looked into their connection to, you know, the utilization of AI, but also like how can it support student learning and, you know, reimagine, so to speak, or their experience with instruction. And that is part of our goal in academics, is now that we have these curricular resources, I think AI, the Magic School up to this point has been a tool, right, for teachers. Some teachers have, as you all saw that Lynn presented, some ways in which they have worked to engage students. We have not currently connected that with any of the curricular resources that we have adopted. And we've been thinking about like, what does that mean for our teams? Because I don't know that my teams yet are fully up to speed. I think we have pockets of people. So we've been talking about what does that look like for them? Where are they? Where do we need to get them up to speed so that they can lead and integrate in the time that they already have? Because as I mentioned, their time for professional learning is limited. So we're going to have to embed it in that space that we have. So more to come and definitely work that we need to do.
Just as a follow-up, I think sometimes it can even be as simple as you're bringing together all of these core resources and bringing this cohesion for that uniformity in that core instruction. And it sometimes can be as easy as like the document that you have of like the instruction that can be easily uploaded, and you tell it like, this is the way that we want you to know this kind of curriculum. So it can be as simple as the docs and Excel sheets that you already have now. I think it's just thinking as you are building it, thinking that you are going to tell the AI at some point, this is what you want and have.
I think I totally agree with that. And I think something that we've talked a lot about too is with our limited teacher learning time, AI for teachers will work best when it doesn't replace their own knowledge and understanding of what excellence looks like in the classroom, right? Because they need to leverage it to hit their vision, but they can't have the vision of what it is if we're not all clear on what that grade level mastery looks like. So I think part of it too is how do we make sure we're getting educators clear and aligned. Many are, right? But just like across our system for what that looks like. And then how do we insert AI into that? Because the flip is if we move too quickly and AI is spitting out, this is a DOK3, but we haven't built the understanding of like, is it? Then we could be going down a path that we don't want to go down. But what I hear you saying is like, there's also a way to use it for teacher facing planning and resources as well as the student facing experience. So point totally heard. Yeah.
And I know there was just some nationwide statistics released that about 50% of teachers nationwide or educators are saying that they're using AI in some way. And Lynn Gershman, when we were all last together, shared the high number of uses by teachers of Magic School in BVSD. And we know that some or many of our teachers are using it to align standards or come up with standards-based practices in their classroom, but we have a lot to build on. So I appreciate your input.
I heard Deanne raise her hand. I'm going to give Lelaney and Jason a time to ask a question if they want to, and then we're going to move on as I'm watching the clock. I know this is going to be, this is an exciting topic for all of us, but I'd like to go Deanne, Alex, or Jason and Lelaney if you have anything, and then we'll keep carrying on. So Deanne.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry I can't be with you today. I am curious about how the coordination of all this curricula helps, which I'm assuming that it really helps new teachers coming into the profession, and how is that part of their onboarding?
Yes, it does. I would say it helps because, again, I think our role in academics is to provide curricular resources that can help them teach the areas in which they're teaching at a standards level. I think part of we collaborate with Katie Mills, his director of professional learning for NEO, so new educator orientation. She also builds in mentors that are in the buildings for new teachers. And then we're working on onboarding plans. So if somebody gets hired new next year, thinking about what's the onboarding for them with the math that they just missed this whole year. And so it's an added layer to the way in which we have to implement, because we'll have basically like three phases going on, but it is something that we are keenly aware of that we need to make sure that we're doing with new teachers.
Thank you.
Melania?
Would you dive just a little bit deeper into the task forces that you use on the front end? That is, to me, it seems like a way that we are shifting culture by coming together at the beginning, building those relationships. And I'd just be interested on who's on those task forces and how they work.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And to Dr. Anderson's point, I think it's been frankly something that as we've sort of looked at what's needed from a change management perspective, it became clear. And I really credit our director of STEAM, Jen Scarbella, really started it with her folks, and now it's spreading because we're seeing a track record of success. So a couple examples: math, social studies, science at different levels have all gone through a rhythm of, first, we do a listening tour of every department, whether it's 612, 912, 68, whatever sort of the area we're looking at is, to just really understand what's the feedback from those folks. Then we look at the feedback, typically me with whatever subset of the STEAM team we're talking about, and we try to sense make, like, what are the key things that are coming up, both positive and areas for growth? What's the work that we're looking at that we need to do in alignment with the strategic plan, and often also, like, what's coming from CDE, like changed math standards, or locally, like, third-year math and science requirements, and how do we think about creating a group that has a very articulated scope of work and purpose to both address some of what's come up in the listening tours and then also bring in what we know we need to be working on. And I think the relationship point is huge. To Asa's point, having the district come and just sit with you to learn from you, I think really sets a tone of collaboration and input. And so depending on the scope of work right now, that looks different ways. We have a secondary math task force that's happening right now at high school where the focus is thinking about third year math graduation requirements, thinking about upcoming math standards, like what courses do we offer and why. And so to do that, it's a lot of shared understanding of what do we value in math at high school? What does that look like and sound like? What does our data say about who's taking which classes and who's not and why? What does our post-secondary national data look like and how are we connecting with that or not? I was sitting in the room where Maura Dudley, one of our math coordinators, had each high school map out their math pathways and then do a walk. And so I think the power of the task forces has also been bringing teachers in to do that learning with us, because I think when you're at this view, you see it all. And when you're in your building, you see your piece, that's your job. And so part of the task force work has been to bring educators in to help understand, dissect the problem, and then co-construct the solution, which, to Dr. Miller's point, then helps us move because we already have done the shared learning together. Typically, task forces are a mix of educators, ideally from all buildings. If not, that's hard sometimes, most, and then a couple administrators. So in our math one, we have two high school principals.
Thank you for sharing that. And that is really impressive to me that piece of change management is being so mindfully engaged. So thank you. I appreciate that. And I can see the benefits coming into form now.
All right. For next best step, this last fall, the board received a large update regarding MTSS implementation and our work to support schools in each of the components. Today, we're actually under the umbrella of MTSS, provide a quick update on the work in reducing special education identification disproportionality and how it's connected to MTSS. So as part of the next best step share is a celebration of our significant disproportionality data. BVSD has no areas of significant disproportionality as of December 1st, 2025. So for the first time in years, we have not been flagged for a year one or year two disproportionality. So CDE typically gives you like a 3-year track. And over the course of the last several years, we've been either in year one watch or year two watch. And going into 2026 school year, we will not be on watch for any areas. So celebration. We know that special education identification has been an ongoing issue concern for many years in BVSD. And I want to be clear that we're not working to prevent identification for students who need an IEP, but we are working to be mindful about not over-identifying in areas either based on language or other. Our SPED team in collaboration work very closely with our MTSS team and our culturally and linguistically diverse department, and they've done significant work with our special ed teams at the school level, as well as with school leaders. We know and understand that while we've not been flagged for this next school year, we continue to engage our educators in long-term sustainability, and we do have a plan for continued next steps. So we definitely are not in a space where we're like, we're not identified, we're good. We know that we have lots of work to do, and we have to keep that pace and cadence going, and we have to keep the work going to make sure that we are following the proper steps and not over-identifying. So a part of that work for us is monthly monitoring through VisLab of current trends of subgroups. So I also don't want this to be just a special education thing. So we have a team of people. My special ed team monitors the data weekly, actually, monthly, and we're watching and identifying those subgroups. We're in collaboration with other departments so that we're watching that. We know that our SLD, so significant learning disability for Hispanic identification, is increasing. And while we are not at the risk ratio that the state has given us, we are very aware that we need to continue working on that. And so currently my team is working on a plan in collaboration with my CLD department to ensure that we're addressing that with schools. Part of that learning is, and we want to revamp the district consultation process for evaluations. So when a student is identified who is a multilingual learner, in the past we have, it's queued up a consult with our language department to go through the data, look at progress of language learning and those types of things. And what we've noticed in our data is we've had a significant amount of decrease in those consultations. And so we're currently working on understanding the problem. Why have we had a decrease in those consultations? What data can we look at? And then how do we increase the consultation so that, again, not to gatekeep that a student can't be identified if they need it, but to make sure that it's not a language issue. We are also working on a plan for professional learning for specifically for our speech language pathologist. They are our language experts in BVSD. So what we're working to do is ensure that they understand the differences between language differences and a disability. So for some collaborative professional learning with my special education team and my culturally and linguistically diverse team on working with our speech pathologists to understand that they have the knowledge that they need to look at that data when that comes up at their school level. And then we're also working to ensure that we continued our system-wide efforts. And this work should and be incorporated into the strategic plan and our MTSS implementation focus. Again, for me, this is not a special education initiative. This is a all initiative. And I think the continued focus on our implementation with MTSS will continue to help us not over-identify students. But for now, we are celebrating that we are not on watch for the next 3 years or 2 years, actually.
And just to add, that comes with significant
yes,
financial implications as well. So if a district is found to be significantly disproportionate, then it locks up some of the funding that we can deploy in the ways that we need to support students, and has to be used for specific purposes. We are still disproportionate. And I think that, that's important to recognize that we've reduced significant disproportionality. And the question I asked the team, and I don't know if they have the answer to that, is how many districts are actually not significantly disproportionate in the Front Range, in the Denver Metro? Because I think it's a very, I think not being, being where we are is the exception, not the norm.
And I did talk to our executive director on that. And in I think four school districts around us, there are, that's why they do a three-year watch, because most districts sometimes are hitting the threshold at some point in an area. So I think it's something we have to be mindful of. And again, I think it never is not a work item for us. Like, it always has to be, whether we're identified or we're not.
Jason and then Deanne.
I just had a question on this chart. I know it shows, I guess, no significant areas of disproportionality, but how does this compare to last year with the improvement? And then what are those, like, if I look at the dots on the left versus the dots on the right, what is the gap and what does that still show? Like, to Dr. Anderson's point, that we still have disproportionality, yeah. But how, like, what is this graph showing us?
So that black line on the side is the CDE risk ratio, which is 2.08, and you have to be under that to not be identified. So for us, in any disability, where we were like right on the mark is for Black and African American, and we were at 1.95. I actually have a briefing that I'll send to all of you this week that gives a lot more than this has. But over the course of the last 3 years, in 2023, we were at 2.10, and this is specifically for this. In 2024, we were at 2.17, and then this year we were at 1.95. Now, obviously, our end, like the end size changes too, right? So as we exit students, those types of things, kids graduate, kids move in. So that is why it's that this data is actually pulled on a monthly basis. And then the state pulls and gives you your rating at December count.
Deanne and then Alex.
I know this is a specific CDE data, but I'm wondering if we have the same kind of data about the number of students with disabilities by socioeconomic status.
We don't have that report from the state per se, but I don't know if that's something we can get or not.
It might be an interesting thing to look at. As we're trying to make improvements and looking for patterns, if this data isn't giving us significant patterns, maybe it is socioeconomics that creates the difference.
We can look into that.
Just a question. Yeah.
I don't know that it's built into the dashboard at this moment, but we can look into it.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I'm delighted we're making progress. I'll amplify Deanne's question about whether economic affluence plays a role, because I know so many parents I know are spending a lot of money that have the money on services that should come from a district in most cases, ideally. So there's a lot of family supplement of tutoring and services and therapy for families that can afford it in this district. So I do think the FRL and the cross tabs, even across race and ethnicity for FRL, are really pretty important for us designing an equitable system. I will add slide 16 is, I've done this before, but this is not an acceptable slide in terms of a graphic. There's so much here that's not labeled that without the last 15 minutes of discussion, I really don't know what anything is. And so I would update graphics like this in the future, label things, make numbers readable, say what they are, because otherwise you have to be an expert to understand what this means.
Okay, so when we are looking at our next UIP considerations around next best step, this is really us taking a look at these very specific student groups to identify how we can improve our consistent growth across all student groups. To Dr. Miller's point, this is really around our change management and our implementation science around MTSS. So the board will remember that last year we were able to engage in an MTSS review led by our Director of Multi-Tier Systems of Support, Shannon Gamble, and her amazing team. And this has allowed us to be able to take some steps both specifically at the school level as well as at the district level. So continuing to build on that and identifying the areas based on that review of areas that they can improve within multi-tier systems of support. And then we can do that as a district level as well. Shannon Gamble is also leading a district group to help us identify what those focus areas could be. One of those identified focus areas is intervention implementation data tracking. So how we can become the most accurate we can be with students progressing through interventions and how we can continue to support that to ensure that we're meeting adequate growth across all student groups. You'll see DDI implementation part of that, just like our previous conversation when we think about DDI implementation as tier one of that multi-tier system of support and how we're ensuring that that's supporting all of our students so that we can identify when and where to intervene and how to support through the different tiers of that system. So ongoing support of that is still going to be a part of this Next Best Step initiative as well. And then again, in every one of these objectives, how we're supporting schools and their very specific 90-day plans, of which that could be improvement within areas that were identified in the MTSS review, and we could be able to target our support of schools in doing that as well. So some potential indicators would be an MTSS progress update using the MTSS rubric. And as we identify specific implementation data around intervention, we can report out on that as well.
P-
Board members, any additional questions or comments on the next best step or steps? Seeing none, we can carry on.
All right, we're going to transition to valued and included before we go on to define the destination in our walk at APEX. Valued and included, as everyone on the board will remember, implementation around this initiative was around cultural competency, an implementation of the discipline framework, increased use of restorative practices, and MTSS as it's applied to behavior. What makes our work and valued and included both difficult and the very right work is the guidance from this board, as well as other members of our team, where we have said, we know that there are different areas, three real main components of the valued and included initiative. And we've seen unbelievable, unprecedented success within two of those areas, specifically around how we are adhering to the discipline framework and our reduced disproportionality and suspensions and our reduced suspensions overall. The other point that's in here is our increased use of restorative practices across the district. That was the focus of our previous UIP. We saw tremendous success as a result of that. What we see as an opportunity right now is what's highlighted within this first bucket, which is that students feel valued and included within their learning environments. And this board, as well as our team, has continued to grapple with what that needs to look like in terms of the right metric for a UIP, how we can identify the right action steps to ensure that we're making progress within this area, as well as looking at research across research best practices, as well as what the state is supporting around student well-being and belonging. So again, we identify the opportunity as students feel valued and included in their learning environments, that first component. And when we talk about multi-tiered systems of support, we also use the term MTSSB. So what is MTSS as it applies to behavior? Within that, we had identified professional learning on de-escalation techniques for staff and professional learning for school leaders on implementing school-wide positive behavior systems. We also have the recommendations from our partners at the Crown Institute on Be Well. So we have year one action items that we have shared with the board that we will continue to support and meet those action items identified from those recommendations. Those primarily focus on our communication processes, data collection, and programming consolidation that we have in place. Again, supporting schools as they identify climate and culture goals, any goals that would fall within valued and included, which may include climate and culture, may include bullying, may include discipline. Any of those specific identified goals that they have, how we support them in doing that. One thing I want to point out in this too is that the majority of our schools, as we did a review of 90-day plans last year, do have a valued and included goal in alignment with within their 90-day plans. So continue to support those efforts. Some indicators could be PD completion, percentage of 90-day plan goals associated with valued and included, school-based belonging efforts that we can capture and highlight, and then uses as strategies that we could share out with other schools, and then completion of Be Well year one action steps that we've identified and shared with the board. Pause here for questions.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Jason and then Elania.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I just have a question on the professional learning side of this. I know Dr. Miller talked about time being such a limitation, and obviously across so many things that teachers that we need to, you know, where we need to have professional learning. Can you talk about kind of what this looks like? What's the time? And then what is the, if we know, kind of what is the feedback on the back end? Do teachers feel like they, you know, after X number of hours of professional learning on this, that they know these techniques, they can implement them? Like what's the result of this?
I can speak to that. So in regards to the de-escalation techniques, that actually over the course of this past year, through a couple venues that we have our leaders in our schools, was a technique that came up as a need. What we're seeing is some overall need in schools of escalated behavior. And again, if you aren't specifically trained in certain areas, it's not necessarily an area that we've provided all teachers in the general education as, again, what the way I think about it is a tool in your tool belt, right? It's not the full CPI training. It's just like, what are some skills that I can use as an adult with children and or with adults, right, to de-escalate? And so I have mentioned that we have limited professional learning time, but we get creative. So what we're doing is we are building teams. I'm currently in this right now. We are building teams between my MTSS team, my special education specialist, our student support teams. We are building teams of trainers. We have a training that we have used with schools from my MTSS team, and we're revamping that. And then getting input from a variety of different stakeholders, because it also came up in negotiations as a need. And then what we'll do is we surveyed all the schools to ask them what kind of training do they want. Do they want a 3-hour training over the course of 3 days? Do they want a 45-minute video? Because some of our schools have been deep in implementing MTSSB. And to Board Member Chavez's point on differentiation, we want to ensure that we're not assuming that they want a certain way. So we're coding all of those schools right now. I have about 36 schools who would like a 2-hour training. And what we'll do is we'll build teams of 2, I believe, and they'll have caseloads of schools. And then what they'll do is work with the school on when they want that training. We're building the training right now. We'll get feedback, and it'll be ready to launch in the fall. Then they'll work with the schools on where they want to implement it. Do they want it at a staff meeting? Do they want it at a late start? Where do they want to build it in? And then each team will have like 2 to 3 schools that they'll do the training at. And then we're also working on building a virtual video that would be about 45 minutes that we'll build the script for, and then that leaders can use when they would like to roll it out at their schedule. So again, our goal with that was to respond, right? That came out as a need from schools, but also to, again, we don't feel like there's any harm in building teacher skills and how to de-escalate kids or in those types of situations where they have high-risk behaviors, those types of things. So that's how we're building it out for that specifically. And then for professional learning for MTSSB, Emma and I were just talking about this yesterday. We will launch that with our June Leadership Academy with leaders. And then we'll be working on, we're already building the arc of learning for late start for next year. And then also thinking about what does that look like throughout PK-12 the rest of next year with our principals.
And I will add that while not on this slide specifically, when we think about professional learning around our most important end users, who are our students and the young people in our schools and their experiences, Dr. Miller, Dr. Gallegos, and myself have interacted with a lot of our high school students, and our young people are telling us that they believe they would like to be part of shaping professional learning in terms of serving on panels, building understanding from their lived experience, and they're offering to lend their voice and experiences to this. So there are some other ways to embed professional learning into the school day and beyond the school day for our educators and our leaders.
Lelania and then Alex.
I have two different questions. First, on this part about students feeling valued and included, can you remind me of the Be Well Year One actions? Just a little recap of that. I'm sorry. Maybe I should have that in my brain better, but I don't.
Sure. And I'm happy to reshare all of the identified Year One action steps. There was across 5 recommendations. And within those actions, it was primarily around communication structure. So working with our communication teams to identify ways that we can support parents and staff and students all being aware of what resources are available, making sure the ease of access to those are there. Also, where we feel like we have redundancies or where we have gaps within the resources that are there, and ensuring that we're consolidating where needed and expanding where needed is the primary outcomes around those.
Okay, thank you. And then when I go back to slide 21, I know that we feel we have progress in restorative practices, and I'm really proud of our district on that. I would not like to miss the boat here, though. After we've had these restorative practices, I continue to ask the question of, did they work, is what does recidivism look like for folks when they're experiencing a restorative practice? And as we look at UIP considerations for 26-28, I just would hate to miss the boat on having done these restorative practices and then not looking at what long-term impact would look like. Though I do understand the focus on the students feeling valued and included.
Yeah, I'd like to amplify that a little bit. I'm really interested in finding out what the outcome data are that are associated with this that would be included in 90-day plans and schools' UIPs and the district's UIP. I find the two metrics we have in the district-wide strategic plan totally out of date and not up to speed with what the action is now that's going on. So it looks like we made a big change on out-of-school suspensions and disproportionality, but now it's kind of stabilized and we're moved on to other things, but it's still our metric. Same with the proportion of kids in restorative justice. Without knowing how good that is, I don't even know if that's a good thing. So I want to know more about those outcomes that Lilenia is talking about. And in general, I'm going to say, as a retail politician who takes meetings when anybody who wants a meeting and then tries to sit in that meeting until people are done talking, this is an area where our parents and our staff say a different story than we tell when we talk about what we've done. The teachers I've talked to, including some who sent us a recent letter, describe really difficult, challenging environments in their classrooms with disruption, with dysregulated students, with not feeling supported when, you know, things go very poorly. And the parents are aware of this, the other kids are aware of this, and our discussion about this seems pretty process-oriented rather than getting a sense of the stories. I recognize that as an elected official, we put ourselves out there. We're supposed to hear those things. So people who have a gripe are right to contact us and talk to us, and maybe that's disproportionate for what we hear. But I hear a very different story from both parents and teachers. And it is of challenges with dysregulated students, with not feeling supported. This lines into the declining enrollment where we don't have enough adults and staff to help respond when something goes very poorly. So I'm looking for support from the district. Here's my to-do, my request would be, I'd like to know what are the concrete measures that people in schools can put into their UIPs and their 90-day plans that are about the outcomes of this. As a governing board member, I really want to know how many kids involved in restorative justice exit our district within the next 2 years. How many kids who are a victim of bullying or accused of bullying leave our district in the next 2 years? What's the demographics and of FRL and race and ethnicity of those figures? So I think we were making great progress. I know a lot of work's going on, but I still hear on the ground of things that really need to get better. And again, to the sequencing and cadence point of what you do, like you do the first stuff first. But I want to know, as we continue to do that, how people on the ground are feeling about it, because the stuff I get as an elected official is disconnected from this discussion. I was wondering if anybody could talk to that and tell me what some of those metrics are that are being used, and how's that data look?
Dr. Aniston raises hand, and then Deanne, I just want to acknowledge that after Dr. Aniston's response, I did hear your hand go up, and so I will be calling on you.
Alex, thanks for that. I actually think two things can be true, that anecdotally we can collect information, and that at a district level, information can tell a different story. I think two things can be true at the same time. And I would say that we're just compiling, we just completed a bullying survey that we've been doing for the past several years. And I don't want to speak to those results because I know Jessica's compiling that. The results that we're seeing is telling a different story than we might be hearing anecdotally, where for the past couple of years, students reporting being bullying or students seeing bullying has gone down. That doesn't mean anytime something like that doesn't happen, it's not emotional and it's not hurtful. And, you know, this... You know, we've talked about this idea of recidivism as a measure and a metric. And I think that we just have to really think about to the extent that restorative practices can eliminate recidivism or maybe reduce recidivism. I think that we just need to think about what the measure might be. I'm not saying that our measures are 100% right, because Alex, the stories you hear, like we all hear, right? And every parent who
whose kid has a negative experience in a school, is a responsibility of ours to try to learn from that and try to respond. And I would say over in the past several years, I think that there's times where we haven't gotten it right and we've tried to make those things right. And there's times where we have gotten it right. And when we get it right, we don't hear about it. And when we don't get it right, we hear about it magnified because it hurts. Like we hear from people that are hurt when their kids get a bad experience, they're hurt. So I want to acknowledge what you're sharing. And I also want to reflect upon, yeah, maybe the data goes up and down, and we have the suspension data we have is 10 times better than any school district around. But there's other sides to this, and we have to always strive to get better. And sometimes it's quantifying that, and then sometimes and maybe where we need to really begin to focus is when we have these instances where the system misses, right? Where the system misses. For one reason or another, sometimes it's an individual, it's an employee, right? Misses, or sometimes when the system misses, how do we fix the system to be more responsive? So I'll say that to the extent that we're working on being valued and included as a priority, I think in some areas and with some subgroups of students, we're doing really, really well. Some subgroups of students, we've made progress. In some subgroups of students, I think about our neurodiverse students, and I think about our twice exceptional students, where they're not feeling the benefits of maybe some of the improvements we've made that other subgroups are. So I just want to acknowledge that the system isn't perfect. We haven't eradicated bullying. We haven't eradicated, our systems aren't 100% foolproof, and we can, but they're better. And I think we're focusing on the right things, and we'll continue to strive to think about metrics to tell that story without leaving out the reality that anecdotally, like if somebody has an experience, an unacceptable experience for them, doesn't matter how many graphs I show and all the progress we're making, they've had an unacceptable experience.
Deanne?
Very briefly, I am not familiar with Be Well recommendations, and so could you send me a link to something that I could educate myself about what that
absolutely. I'll send that back out to the board.
We can actually include that in news and notes this week for everyone to have a refresher.
I have a question about this, the valued and included, and a little bit to Alex's point. And one thing that is challenging is our strategic plan is a 5-year plan, right? We locked that plan in for 5 years. The UIP is an opportunity for us to continue to tinker on a 2 years within that 5-year plan, and then those 90-day plans even more frequently. Looking at our dashboard, I just pulled up our dashboard on the climate survey results that we use as metrics for feeling evaluated and included. I just, there's differences. I feel like if you look at elementary school students, 87%, 88%, report feeling evaluated included, high schoolers, 86%, middle schoolers, 81%. And so like the opportunity there in helping our schools identify the ways in which their unique community or their age group and these new UIPs can be hone in and get more specific. So a goal might look different at a middle school level, or the need might be different at a middle school level than a high school level. And how can we leverage the UIP strategically and our district UIP goal to allow some flexibility at our site level to really get at the root cause at our sites. And again, this is going back to like how I think about the structure of the UIP and the benefit is like that root cause analysis is really critical. And I think it is outstanding. Actually, I think 86% of our kids, 88% of our kids feeling valued and included, that metric does feel pretty, it feels good. That's a significant proportion of our students. And I agree, there is still some work to do. I don't think we'll ever get rid of bullying. That'll never go down to zero. There's some developmental age. There's just kids are kids. There's some learning to be done there. But I do wonder, as you're looking toward the UIP, how designing and crafting those goals to continue to work towards this 5-year plan that we will be in until we renew it, and helping helping individual schools be able to dial in ways that is really meaningful so we can continue to see forward improvement that's meaningful so our community feels that in meaningful ways. Dr. Anderson.
I want to be realistic.
we have a different challenge around valued and included that's coming, and that's declining enrollment because we're going to be shifting student schools. We're going to be shifting our footprint. So there'll be a new baseline that we will have to know and understand, right? So as I think about the things getting that are potential risks, right? If we do a risk analysis of where we are, I think that comes to me as top of mind. So, and actually that, you know, the work we're doing around declining enrollment, to the extent that we can do that well and bring people together the ways that we're doing now, which is by listening and hearing where people's values are, I do think there's a risk of it overshadowing a UIP. Does that make sense? Right. So to the extent that we're going to have different school configurations, some schools won't be here, other schools may go bigger, we're going to be bringing communities together, right? And then we have these aspirational, high functioning, like systems across that, it should help insulate us from some of those things. But I think we do also need to know and understand that depending upon how that process ends up playing out, could significantly impact things like valued and included. I think that, you know, there's going to be kids who, I just think that there's a ton of dynamics that I do not want to let go of. And I'll be very clear with you as board members in our community. We know that, we understand that, right? And some of it's going to be unavoidable if we're going to close and consolidate schools. That it's just true. So as we think about building this UIP and building it in ways that are thoughtful, right? I think that there is some other things that we haven't been considering that we need to probably begin to realize are going to be impacting us. And to the extent that we're able to hold things together, move things forward in the midst of what will be probably some of the most significant changes in our school district in 20 some years, we just need to understand that.
Alex.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for that, Dr. Anderson. I agree 100%. And that's why one of the reasons I continue to be really impressed by our community engagement process. And one of the things I really take away from it is the depth of our parents engaging and having a student-based, like a student-focused approach to the whole thing. Because at the end of the day, 1,000, 1,200 elementary school kids will be moving from one school to another because of this, probably. And each of that is an opportunity to be excited or, you know, have a really bad time and experience trauma that disrupts everything else. And the scale of that for elementary schools is huge. And that's why getting at, and that's not just for the sending schools, the receiving schools are going to have their culture be challenged by new students, new parents with expectations they had in an old school. So I really think that transition year for the sending and receiving schools is huge for investment and support and adjustment of what we do so that those elementary schools are primarily helped with managing that transition as well as possible. And that's where I want to make sure that we're capturing the outcome data that gets at whether or not whatever we do in those 2 years, let's say the year of planning and the first year at least of implementation, that we're keeping track of how the students are feeling and how they're doing, and not just tracking whether we did the process that we picked 4 years ago and that the implementation is moving along. So it's exactly to your point is why I want to accelerate or amplify the outcome-based approach, at least to our elementary schools, for the student well-being and valued included. Because there's great opportunity for kids to not feel included when they get there, and there's challenges for parents who have thought their previous school was serving their kids' need and not sure the new school wants to serve them or is able. So that's the kind of stuff I'm worried about.
We are going to move on to define the destination. Before we do, this is such a good conversation. I appreciate all of the input, the questions, and the discussion. And just a time check that APEX is expecting us around 11:15, and the Culinary Center is expecting us at around noon. And we might not make those exact deadlines, but just a time check.
Thanks for that. Yeah, we can move through, and board members, we can hold some.
That's a very kind way to say.
Hello. So I'm really excited to be able to share an update on Define the Destination. We ground our work of Define the Destination in BVSD's Grad Plus framework, This framework is a key part of the district's vision to ensure every student graduates with more than a diploma, equipped with real-world skills, meaningful experiences, and multiple pathways for success beyond high school. Rooted in BVSD's commitment to preparing students for an evolving future, the Grad Plus framework expands opportunities for students to earn college credit, industry certifications, the seal of biliteracy, and engage in authentic work-based learning experiences. You can see our implementation benchmarks there on the right. Together, these four quadrants help students connect their learning to their interests and future goals while building confidence, skills, and credentials that matter in college, career, and life. The Grad Plus framework reflects BVSD's belief that success after graduation is not a one-size-fits-all, but built through multiple and flexible opportunities starting at as early as elementary school and continuing on through graduation. First, I'll share about work-based learning as part of the Grad Plus framework. In BVSD, we use Colorado's work-based learning continuum, starting in preschool all the way up through the 12th grade. The continuum is designed to intentionally build students' awareness, exploration, and preparation and training for future careers, starting with early exposure in elementary school and culminating in real-world, hands-on experiences like internships in high school. The work-based learning continuum experiences help students graduate with not only academic knowledge, but also the skills, experiences, and connections needed to thrive in college, career, and in our community. The Dare to Dream program brings work-based learning experiences at to ensure every elementary school student begins exploring their future early, not by chance, but by design. Through career weeks, guest speakers, and hands-on experiences, students connect what they're learning in the classroom to real-world possibilities, hearing directly from professionals across a wide range of fields, and imagining themselves in those roles. As part of our broader work-based learning continuum, Dare to Dream sparks curiosity, builds relevance, and helps students begin to see their interests, strengths, and identities, and how those can shape a future full of possibilities. This slide shows how we are scaling work-based learning experiences across the PK-12 continuum. At the elementary level, you can see the rapid expansion of Dare to Dream from just 2% of students participating during the 23-24 school year to 15% last year and reaching 100% of students in the elementary school this year, ensuring universal early career exposure. In middle school, ICAP completion continues to grow steadily, reflecting stronger systems to support students in exploring and planning their future pathways. ICAP stands for Individual and Career Academic Plan. This is a personalized, multi-year process that helps students explore their interests, set goals, and map out the coursework and experiences needed to succeed in college, career, and life. At the high school level, participation in work-based learning experiences is also increasing significantly, from over 600 experiences last year to an anticipated 4,000 plus this year. High school work-based learning participation includes course enrollment, job shadows, industry-sponsored projects, workplace tours, and on-the-job training, career speakers, and BVSD-facilitated internships. The overall trend is clear. We are rapidly expanding access and ensuring more students engage in meaningful work-based learning at every level. The next quadrant that I'll share about is the Seal of Biliteracy. The Seal of Biliteracy is a formal and nationally recognized seal that graduates earn by demonstrating proficiency in multiple languages, preparing them for success in a global workforce and diverse community. The Seal of Biliteracy matters because it signals to college and employers that a student has valuable multilingual skills. It promotes cultural awareness and global competence, and it recognizes and honors students' linguistic assets, especially for multilingual and heritage language speakers. This slide highlights progress in students earning the Seal of Biliteracy across student groups. Overall, we continue to see growth across nearly all groups, with especially strong gains among Hispanic and Latino students and students from dual language homes, who are projected to be overrepresented by about 7% this year. This reflects the strength of our multilingual programs and the assets our students bring. We've also significantly expanded to a larger range of languages, from awarding the seal in 15 languages last year to 23 languages this year, exceeding our goal of providing 20 languages. Of great importance to note, by the end of the school year, nearly all student groups are expected to be proportionately represented among seal earners. Overall, the data shows both growth and increasing access. More students from more backgrounds earning recognition for bilingualism and biliteracy. The next Grad Plus quadrant that I'll highlight is college before graduation. There are five ways that BVSD students can earn college credit before ever even stepping on a college campus as a full-time student. The Grad Plus team has worked really hard to make college-level examination program testing available for BVSD students right here in our own district without having to test at a college campus. These tests are similar to AP exams in that they are run through the College Board and are accepted at most post-secondary institutions nationwide. Here in Colorado, all public post-secondary institutions accept CLEP exams for college credit. Advanced placement and international baccalaureate classes provide college-level courses right here in our high schools. Dual and concurrent enrollment both allow high school students to earn college credit, but they differ primarily in location and instruction. Concurrent enrollment features college-level courses taught at the high school by qualified high school teachers. Dual enrollment refers to courses taken on a college campus taught by college faculty. We are committed to continue making these opportunities accessible to students. Earning college credit while still in high school can mean real savings in time and savings in tuition down the road. High school students who earn college credit are significantly more likely to go to college and finish a degree, making it one of the most impactful college and career readiness strategies used nationwide. This slide shows the results of college credit attainment before high school graduation in action. Looking at the left chart, AP remains our highest volume program, followed by concurrent enrollment. What's encouraging is that across most every category, our overall anticipated 2025-2026 numbers are holding steady or growing. The chart on the right tells an even more compelling story. We're projecting a jump to 52% of high school students earning college credit this school year. That means that more students are taking advantages of these opportunities than ever before. And this slide breaks down college credit attainment by racial and ethnic group. The good news is that nearly every group is trending upward and in the anticipated 25-26 data. Asian students continue to lead at 67%, and American Indian and Alaska Native students show a notable jump from 14 to an anticipated 33%, which is meaningful growth. Hispanic and Latino students, who make up 21% of high school population, are earning college credit at a rate of 34%. These proportionality patterns are something we monitor closely and we think about all the time as we continue to ensure equitable access to these opportunities. All right, and the last quadrant that I'll present on is industry certifications. We have taken the Seal of Climate Literacy under the Grad Plus wing, and it's part of the industry certifications quadrant. This spring, we will be celebrating the second graduating class to earn the Seal of Climate Literacy. The Seal of Climate Literacy is a national recognition, which is an additional endorsement that is connected to the high school diploma. The Seal of Climate Literacy is awarded to students who demonstrate a strong understanding of climate science, sustainability, and environmental action. The Seal of Climate Literacy matters because students who earn the seal have shown knowledge of climate systems and human impact, understanding of environmental justice and sustainability, and the ability to apply learning through engagement and action projects. In order to earn the Seal of Climate Literacy, students complete two climate-related courses and a portfolio of experiential learning and action experiences. These can include industry certification, additional coursework, work-based learning, and other actions related to local climate programs. We are excited to honor 20 graduating students last year, which was our first year, and we are more than doubling that in year two. In addition to our 70 students earning the Seal of Climate Literacy this year, there are more than 110 students in grades 6 through 11 who are already working toward earning their Seal of Climate Literacy. To support the Seal of Climate Literacy, we have provided the following opportunities as students' portfolios can include industry certification, additional coursework, work-based learning, and other actions related to the climate problem. Over the last 2 years, we have added 5 climate-related courses to our course catalog, offered 12 certifications, participated in 46 work-based learning opportunities, including jobs, internships, and volunteer opportunities, offered 8 courses where students earn college credit before graduation, supported interest in climate literacy in the middle school through a junior SEAL experience, and of course, we continue to support Green Youth Council. Students across our district are earning industry certified experience certifications through career and college education, reimagined in BVSD as Accelerate. Before walking through the specific Accelerate pathways available to our district and in high school websites in our course registration materials, I want to highlight an important shift in how we think about this work. Accelerate is more than a rebrand. The name reflects both rigor of a programming and the opportunities it creates. For students to accelerate their futures, their careers, and their passions, these pathways equip students with the skills of real-world experience and need to succeed after graduation. Unlike traditional vocational programs, which are often designed to narrow slice of students, Accelerate is built for everyone. We believe every student can thrive in rigorous, relevant learning. Through these pathways, students earn industry certifications and college credit while engaging in hands-on, work-based experiences. And as the board is aware, thanks to our voters, we are expanding and improving spaces where students engage in Accelerate pathways in BVSD. Along with the beautiful new spaces that are being built, we are working alongside our high school leadership teams to ensure that we have robust and clear Accelerate pathways that align with our local economic needs and student interests in these spaces. On this slide, you are able to see the pathways of investment that our bond dollars have renovated and improved. Given the state requirements for defined CTE pathways, we are providing schools with their We are supporting schools in their various stages of implementation and strengthening these pathways. All of our Accelerate pathways are now published and visible to our community. Parents can find information on all Accelerate pathways on our district website, as well as on their high school websites directly. Our community can see pathways organized by schools, as pictured on this slide, or by pathway topic. We have a clear course progression published, information on the available college credit within each course, as well as the industry certifications that students can earn in their courses. We also created printable one-pagers available both in English and in Spanish that outline all of the information for schools to leverage during the course selection process. We have also ran a feature in the February spot highlighting all of our pathways and the benefits that they offer to students. We will continue to leverage these websites and print materials during district events, enrollment nights, and course selection to ensure our students and community knows all that we have to offer. We are expanding our Accelerate Pathways at APEX over the next 2 school years. Again, with the generous support of our voters, APEX has been undergoing massive construction and upgrades that will allow us to offer additional new programs. You can see which programs will be added in this slide. As Dr. De La Cruz mentioned, at the end of this presentation, we will have the opportunity to tour APEX. I do want to highlight something important. APEX and Accelerate Pathways provide students with the opportunity to engage in the Big Three, which are Colorado Department's Education's priority outcomes to ensure every student leaves high school with either college credit, industry recognized credentials, or work-based learning experiences, setting them up for success beyond graduation. I'm proud to share that BVSD is ahead of the curve as related to the Big Three, thanks to our Grad Plus framework, which has already been providing students with these valuable opportunities for college and career readiness.
Board members, I think maybe we have time for 2 very brief questions, and then we'll move on to the last section of this presentation. Any questions? Anna.
I do just want to give a big kudos. Bianca and I did have a chance to talk about some of the ways that students are able to attain college credits while still in high school, and just the on-the-ground participation that they have with the students was just remarkable to hear about and to learn about. This just makes me really excited, and it brings me to my other hat as a commissioner on higher education, on figuring out how we can move it to the next step on potentially guaranteed admissions, whether it's to a school or whether it's to a program. And so I am just opening up the invitation to work further to make sure that we connect both of those to ensure that all of these programs get connected to the correct or to the proper institution of higher education.
Thank you. That's definitely something we want to continue to build upon, and that's something that's in the works. So I'm excited to hear your offer.
Okay, we'll move on to the UI. Oh, one last brief question, Alex.
Yes. Actually, I just, again, want to congratulate the district's leadership and Bianca and her team for everything on this. It's just an amazing sign of progress. I don't have time for my questions, so I'm going to email some questions, and I would love some written response and information for those later.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to spending some time on UIP development, which I know we've touched on throughout the presentation. In terms of the development timeline, as we look toward developing a new UIP, we anticipate recommendations from DAC in the spring that we embed into our development process. And that process typically occurs throughout the summer, leading to the team bringing a draft of the UIP to the board in early fall for feedback that informs potential revisions, and finalizing the UIP as it is due to CDE in October, followed by progress updates to the board. Jessica has been working on envisioning and configuring growth and achievement targets and KPI dashboards with input that has come from the board, and she's going to provide that draft information next.
Okay, so before we kind of jump into, as Chris named it earlier, the considerations that we're talking about for growth targets for the next UIP cycle, I just want to start with high level, reminding us, grounding us in median growth percentiles or an MGP. So every year the state anchors an MGP of 50, as for a district to think about an MGP of 50, meaning on average, your students are growing at a rate that's comparable to their academic peers. If the MGP is higher than 50, you're outpacing or growing at a faster rate. And if it's lower, you're growing at a slower rate. And that's always thinking about globally all students, not taking into account any particular group that a student might be a part of, whether that's a racial ethnic group or being a multilingual learner, et cetera. So that's important to keep in mind as I walk you through this table. So what we've been talking about is setting a growth standard for groups of students, and all of those growth standards meeting or exceeding that benchmark of 50 of average. And thinking about that differentially based on the historical performance of students in the district, as well as the targets that we have for them specifically. So thinking about all students in the district overall, our Asian students, gifted and talented students, multiracial and white. These are the groups here in BVSD that have historically been high performing. We're talking about an MGP threshold or a minimum growth rate of 55 or higher for those groups. And compared to the state, these groups are also tend to be higher performing. In the state, these groups tend to have an average MGP of 54. So we're proposing setting this target at 1 point above. In the BVSD context, that's actually not looking for an increased growth rate. It's looking for them to maintain a growth that is above the state average. And I just want to make sure we conceptualize this well. So I have a loose analogy to the Boulder that we have coming up. So if we think about the Boulder, all the kids in Colorado are running the Boulder. If we're at an MGP of 55, we are running ahead of the pack already. And we also think about the fact that every year, all of the school districts and across the state, we're all trying to serve our students better. We're all trying to work to help them achieve the best that they can. So that MGP of 50, conceptually, even though it's a 50 every year, conceptually, it can move around. And so when we're suggesting we stay at an MGP of 55, we're saying we're continuing to run faster than the average in the pack. And that running faster might actually be harder as others are continuing to improve what they're doing. So just conceptually thinking about, even though that box says a plus zero, know that maintaining something above the state average at a 55 is statistically difficult for a system the size of BVSD. So that is a challenging standard that we are setting there. For the next groups of students, our FRL eligible, Hispanic, multilingual learners, and our students with IEPs, we're looking at an MGP threshold of 52 or higher. In the state, for these groups, they tend to perform at an MGP of about 46. So we're setting this target at 6 points higher than where these groups are in the state. And for our BVSD context, that's looking at accelerating growth from 2 to 4 points, depending on the subject or the student group. So we're setting an ambitious gap closing pace for these groups of students. We are not wanting them to stay where they are. We're wanting them to speed up, catch up, move up in their Boulder race. And then this last group of students, the American Indian, Alaskan Native, or our Black African American students. If you were here in the fall when I talked about the CMAS results, we talked about how for these groups, growth tends to be bouncy. It's unstable. It moves around. And that's just mathematically what happens when you have a small group in a system. So our goal for these students is saying we know there's going to be some instability, but can we get that instability to happen at or above 50 so that we are growing and maintaining above the state average? And then for these groups, that's a 4-point increase. And in our BVSD context, again, looking at these students to move up in the pack from 1 to 4 points as far as how we're setting growth targets. Now, we know that growth comes before achievement. So because we have these growth targets, we have related achievement targets. So when we're talking about achievement, this is the percentage of students that are meeting and exceeding grade level standards. For that those first groups, we're looking at steady, steady incremental gains, looking to increase the percent meets exceeds for 1 to 2% overall, and then in these particular groups. And then for those groups that we're looking to challenge to increase their growth rate, to move them up in the pack, we're aiming for high velocity growth there as well, looking to close those achievement gaps, looking for 4% increase over the UIP timeline. And then lastly, for those last groups, resulting in looking to grow that percent meets exceeds for 2%. Now, all of this is based off of the 24-25 school year. So when our most recent year of results come in, we'll come back to these numbers and think about, does this still make sense with what we've seen, but kind of how we're thinking about it based on the data we have available to us right now.
Okay, there's only one slide left. So we can pause for a couple. I think I saw Lelaney and then Lelaney's hand for sure then. Okay.
I'm wondering if there's been any thought of pulling out gifted and talented students as a student group. Because I would think that growth targets may be able to be different for that particular group. achievement as well. But I guess I'm not sure about the lumping all of those groups together.
That's a good point. So gifted and talented students are challenging when thinking about these sorts of things, right? Because we hit a ceiling effect. So last year we had 92.4% of that group meeting or exceeding grade level standards. So what does growth look like? What is reasonable for seeing a lift in their percent meets exceeds? So that's a good point we can take back to the table and think about if we want to think about them differently from how they are here now. Thank you.
And just to note too, I think if we think about them different, the gifted and identified students are gifted in all areas. So it might not be literacy or math. It could be something else too. So if we comb it out, we'd have to look at who's identified in what.
One thing to piggyback, I mean, traditionally when the board has seen the UIP, it's been without the gifted addendum. Like there's typically an addendum to the UIP for gifted and talented identified students. It might be helpful to see that when we get the draft UIP back as much as we can, just to give some context and understanding around those students. Alex.
Yeah, that was my question. On this chart, is each row a separate, like grouped together thing, or are those five subgroups in the first row that we're tracking each of? I'd like to know what the subgroups are doing, not some aggregate of that, to Lenny's question.
Yeah, so we are looking at them separately. The targets are just kind of set similarly for different,
okay,
those different bands.
Yeah, and another thing I think would be useful in the presentation of this one, or the previous slide, I always think it's helpful for the public or people to know what the distribution curve looks like for how many percent above and below 50 actually most schools and populations are. So like it's not a really wide curve. And so when you get 6 or 8, you know, percent above 50, you get to 56, it's a small tail of schools that get there. And people are thinking, oh, it's just average. So 5 over 50 is not a big deal. It's like, well, actually that's a huge deal in terms of the numbers of schools. So at some level, translating this into what's the percent of schools that are growing at that level would really, I think, make this more meaningful to a lot of the public or to me as a board member. Again, I like these goals. I like to break out as many of them as we can. I think when it gets to our gifted and talented, it's good to break out actually the 2E stuff. And I remain really interested in a crosstab of our IEPs by FRL status. So knowing what's the difference when it comes to affluent parents of kids with IEPs and less privileged parents of kids with IEPs.
Thank you.
I just want to say, I appreciate the thoughtfulness that went into establishing some level of increase over time versus compared to the state average and our average. Not that long ago, I felt like sometimes there were these really ambitious targets of like 6% growth. And you're like, how are we going to get there? So I appreciate some thoughtful targets. You addressing the fact that based on when we get those CMAS scores, there might be some finessing depending on how our students did last year. And just also all of the work that we've done in the background, creating the instructional infrastructure, creating the systems that we have in place are going to help us continue to be increasingly thoughtful and improves our ability to meet these targets in a realistic fashion. So kudos to everybody involved. Kudos to Dr. Alzin and sort of rethinking our approach to our UIP targets and across the board. It's all coming together very nicely in a way that is really going to do nothing but benefit our students.
And then one last, thank you. Maybe you should never have given me the clicker. One last thing. We received some really good feedback about the KPI dashboard and looking for some refinement and improvement there. So just for clarity, we're not looking at redoing the whole thing. There's just a few key visuals that we're looking to update. And this is just a mock-up. It's not meant for you to see all the details. I just want to give you a preview of coming events, the conversation that we've been having. So what you're looking at here, the top is currently how we're displaying the percentage of students who meet and exceed grade level standards. And the bottom is kind of the draft revision. And two things I really want to point out, you'll maybe can see because it's small, I know, some horizontal bars. Those horizontal bars would be the UIP targets directly onto the KPI dashboard so that you can see at first glance how that progress is happening. And then the two green bars and then the two orange bars would immediately, without hovering or going to a different view, being able to see how are the percentage of students meeting and exceeding based on their FRL status, or for Hispanic Latino learners versus non-Hispanic Latino learners. So just trying to make things more easily readily accessible for meaning making without needing to necessarily use all the different hovers, and happy to have conversation about the other updates that we're looking at, but hoping to kind of roll this out all together with the new school year when our next results come out, the new UIP cycle, and the new goals.
I think that is a great update. I also like the reminder of what our goal is on those charts, so we can see if we're meeting, exceeding, falling behind the targets we've internally established. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
Okay, board members, any last burning questions or comments before we move over to APEX?
And as we shift to APEX, I just want to say that we'll be seeing the newly renovated CTE spaces, and those that are completed so far in the bond project include biomedical science, pharmacy technician, medical assisting, sports medicine, physical therapy, emergency medical technician and emergency medical responder, criminal justice and crime scene investigation, and the teacher academy. And the work that's underway for expansion include computer science, film and video arts, aerospace, quantum manufacturing, and optic engineering. And there will also be renovations to existing spaces in the construction trades, auto, collision, and welding. So you can see there's a lot in place and a lot underway.
Thank you for that. Thank you, team, for this update. It was really helpful. Looking forward to see how the UIP shapes up as we head to the fall. For the public and anybody tuning in, we will be heading over to APEX Center and having lunch in our culinary center. So our business meeting within this room is adjourned. Thank you. Have a great week, everyone.